We're gaining the capacity to take the pulse of the planet. That doesn't mean we understand it, but the technology is here, especially in Alaska. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska, a weekly statewide conversation. I'm Steve Heimel. Scientists are meeting this week to plan Gulf Watch Alaska, monitoring the waters and coast of the Gulf of Alaska. You should be able to get into it yourself online. Our telephone number, statewide toll-free, 1-800-478-8255. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. This project's been the dream of some since 1989. More statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. Many Alaska business owners are paying too much for energy. The Commercial Building Energy Audit Program identifies an average of 30% in energy savings. The application period runs November 1st through December 20th. To learn more, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
So it's meeting this week of the PIs. PI stands for Principal Investigators. These are people that are in charge of scientific research. And we have PIs and a director of the program with us today in the studio. It's called Gulf Watch Alaska, and it's being funded by the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council. In 1989, there was an oil spill, and the damage to the natural resources was settled with the state and federal governments by Exxon for about $1 billion. And that money was then used to do what could be done to restore the environment. A lot of that was habitat acquisition. Some of it was science. Some of it was damage assessment. And some of it was monitoring. And the monitoring has continued, and now we know will continue. I guess Gulf Watch Alaska is in year 2 right now. And Chris Holdry, director of the NOAA Katsina Bay Laboratory in Kachemak Bay, is with us. And so you're one of the scientific leads of this program?
Yeah, Steve, I'm the science lead for Gulf Watch Alaska. So it's a multi-agency, multidisciplinary ecosystem monitoring program. And what we're trying to do is pull together monitoring of species that were injured by the spill, the environmental conditions that affect them, as well as we have a lingering oil monitoring component to complement the species and environmental condition monitoring.
So it's just monitoring the species, you getting into oceanography and plankton?
Yeah, exactly. So when we talk about marine conditions, we're talking about the oceanographic conditions that affect them, and we're looking both within Prince William Sound, on the outer Kenai Peninsula coast, and in Lower Cook Inlet, and then also the bottom-up forcing of the system, so plankton, phytoplankton, zooplankton measurements, and then the birds, the marine mammals, the more of the, as we say, the charismatic megafauna as well.
So how does the data show up? What is the, go to on a website? How do we get to see this information?
Sure.
And who's going to be theorizing based on it?
Yeah, one of the big advantages, so Gulf Watch Alaska is funded by the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council, which has funded a lot of work over the past several decades. And as part of this integrated program, we're putting information both on a shared research site, so all the investigators, all the scientists in the program can share data amongst themselves right away. And then we're making it publicly available through a data portal, so the Gulf of Alaska data portal.
I think probably for a lot of our listeners, the context might be profitable to build up here. The fact of the matter is that unless there's money in it, it's hard to get the research dollars to research it. And so if it's a fish, you know, everybody wants to know how to get more fish that I can sell. And so there's a lot of money spent on fisheries research. But if it's a kind of fish that you can't sell, there's not so much research money available for it.
Yeah, long-term monitoring is a real challenge in any case. And one of the things, particularly as you mentioned, so small fish, forage fish, are the linchpins of the system. You know, lots of things eat them. Other fish eat them. Marine mammals eat them. Seabirds eat them. There's a lot of, you know, they're the centerpiece of how the system works, except we don't eat them other than, you know, herring and things like that we do. So you don't get as much, it's hard to get money to monitor those, to actually keep track of those species, as important as they are, as important as we all recognize they are. One of the pieces of the program that we're looking at with Gulf Watch Alaska is to improve techniques for monitoring forage fish. And John Pyatt, who's also with us here today, has that project. And that's, so how can we do it smarter, more efficiently, get better information on that species, on those species in particular?
John Pyatt, research scientist, U.S. Geological Survey, Alaska Science Center. That sounds like a setup for you.
I think it was, yes. Yeah, so it is a challenge. And Prince William Sound is historically, there's, you know, been a variety of attempts to study forage fish there. Yeah, a little bit of a challenge because it's the forage fish are, they're always a challenge. I mean, they're ephemeral. You know, they come and go very quickly. Typically, schools can be distributed. You know, they're very dense. They're very aggregated, and then they're distributed widely. And so, sampling them is always a challenge.
Yeah, we've got fishermen listening right now, and very aware of because of course herring is a commercial species, but herring are anything but predictable. They're always trying, but essentially you have to get up in the air and watch and see when they ball up, and then try to guess why and where they're going to go and on like that. But it defies prediction every year, and so the expression often is used is squirrely. You know, herring research is squirrely. So are the rest of them, the capelin, the sand lance, and the rest of them, are they squirrely too?
Well, they are, yes, and you hit the nail on the head there. And so I think the researchers are getting a little squirrely too, because we started out with this taking traditional approaches. We've studied forage fish in some other areas similar, you know, Lower Cook Inlet and down in Glacier Bay in southeast Alaska, enclosed sea areas that are relatively lots of shoreline, lots of shallows, near shore areas that schooling fish might be abundant and are. And we've had good luck in those places, but in Prince William Sound, it's been more of a challenge. There are fewer schools and they're even more dispersed. And the sand lance are very close to shore. They like to bury their head, you know, bury their bodies into the sand, literally, hence the name. So they're oftentimes buried in the sediment and you can't even catch them. I had a student years ago who the only way he could get adult sand lance was to go down to the beaches at low tide with a shovel and bang the ground. And then the fish would emerge.
Okay, that's one innovative. What else have you got, John?
Well, you know, the fishermen are going to laugh because, you know, we started with traditional, well, we'll go out with the trawl, midwater trawl,
yeah.
Which is, and we've got, you know, we recently acquired some, you know, the sophisticated gear, that the best you can get to find them acoustically, and then the nets and the gear to tell where that net is going in the water column, exactly how deep it is, and we chase them. But they're fairly smallish schools, and it's not, you know, surprisingly, you know, you think these schools, when you look at them on the sounder, they look pretty big, and then you drive a boat over them. Of course, the boat is big and noisy, and it scares them. And if they're not really big, you tend to just scare them away altogether. You drive the net through, and you pull the net up, and there's nothing in it. So we tried that. We tried jigging. We've tried video cameras, and ironically, these are all things that you know, Apex, or years ago when there was a project funded in Prince William Sound called Apex to do similar work. They went through all of this themselves. We thought we should try all of these methods as well, and we came to the same conclusion, which is we need to have an airplane up there.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were listening to some of the local folks there, too, and people who'd done some of this work in the past. So, in fact, last summer, we got together with some of the herring folks, and we put somebody up in a plane, and we zipped around, and we... The problem with airplanes, and it's a great way to spot them, but, you know, to study sand lance and capelin, I mean, you have to get them. We want to catch them. We want to see what their body condition is, how big they are, how old they are. And so we're doing both. We're using an airplane to spot the schools, and we're using a boat to try and get in there and then get the sample of those. And we're trying to marry those two methods. They're very different. Aerial surveys have been used in some countries for monitoring schooling fishes.
You know, what's really fun about what you're talking about is that that's the nuts and bolts of science. that people really like puzzling these things out. But you gotta try things.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, there's a lot of technology, and technology frequently doesn't work like you think it's going to.
Yeah,
we just have to persist to try and actually get those data points that you're looking for.
There's a lot of failure in forage fish work.
Your best lessons come from the failures too.
Yeah. Well,
I just hope my funders are listening to this.
Yeah. Well, I always thought of you as a bird man. You know, ever since days after the XM Valdez spill, some guy stood up at a scientific meeting and said, I got an oil bird here. I don't know what to do with it. And you stood up and said, give it to me. It was a cormorant, I believe. And it was definitely oiled. And after that, you looked into the MERS, were very damaged by the spill in the Barren Islands. And, these birds... don't they tell us something about forage fish, John?
Well, they do, and those of us who work on birds, seabirds are often fond of saying they're great indicators of the fish because, it's great to study the birds for their own sake, and certainly my agency and other Department of Interior agencies have a mandate to study the birds for their own sake. But the problem is, since I ever got started in this racket, which was now almost 30 years ago, I got started because puffins were starving and they weren't getting enough fish. And, you know, so my whole career has just been always having people say, well, the birds are having problems. Their populations are going down. What do you think is the problem? And, you know, it often goes back to the fish. Even in the case of the oil spill, we blamed a lot of what we saw happening with seabirds on the oil spill. But it was shortly, you know, it wasn't long before we realized that there had been major changes in the fish communities in the Gulf of Alaska. So you can't study seabirds without studying forage fish. And that's how I ended up getting sucked into the vortex of trying to understand what the forage fish are doing when I myself am, you know, mostly just a seabird biologist. But I have good fisheries people who work for me, and they actually know something about fish.
Well, but what I'm getting at is maybe if you can't catch the fish, you can catch the birds and do the analysis of what the birds have been.
Well, yeah, and we do that. I mean, I just finished a project in the Aleutians this summer and last.
It's fairly easy to barf out a bird, I understand.
Well, we were stealing food from baby puffins,
uh-huh.
Which is much more preferable to the old-fashioned way, which was to shoot them. And in Prince William Sound, we don't have a lot of puffins, and nobody really wants us to shoot birds.
No,
and
they don't.
It's an old method, and it's tried and true, but it's terminal and not good for the population.
It's not politically correct. John.
Well, you know, and not even so much that. It's not, I think there's alternate ways to do that nowadays. And so we can capture birds and get blood, and we can look at, you can use isotopes. It's a new tool to kind of look at where they're feeding in the food web. And we can, some of the birds carry fish around, so we can actually identify them when they carry them. So,
but generally, I guess what you're saying is they're generally quite opportunistic, and if they can't get sand lance, they'll get whatever they need to get.
Well, to a degree, you know, but if the sand, I mean, they like oily fish, so, you know, they need oily fish. So sand lance and capelin and herring, these are all great oily fishes, and they're all very tasty. Juvenile pollock, widely consumed by these birds too, but it's got about half the nutritive value, energy value. So, that means you have to eat a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have twice the diet. I never knew this till we actually had a student who raised birds on different kinds of fish and found out that the intestines have to be like nearly twice the length. I mean, you actually have to have more digestive capacity if you're going to live on pollock than if you're going to live on oily fish. So there's a lot of consequences to a major shift in diet, which happened in the Gulf of Alaska. But the birds are great indicators, and we are studying their biology, their what they feed on, their breeding success, their population trends, not just in Prince William Sound, but in the Gulf and in the Bering Sea. I mean, a whole bunch of people. I say we collectively, the community, we collect a lot of data, and the birds are telling us there's been major changes in the ecosystem for the last 30 years.
Well, you made reference to what was called a regime shift, and I think how we even know there was a regime shift is actually a testament to the value of ecosystem monitoring. That you don't actually, directed research can be wonderful. Research asking questions based on a theory can be wonderful, but just the raw gathering of information, in this case, shrimp trawls by the Department of Fish and Game, who, you know, just happened to catch everything else as well as the shrimp, showed us there was a big change in the whole species composition in the Gulf of Alaska. And they weren't even looking for it, but it's just, it was in the data. It was in a long time series of data.
Yeah, and it's pretty classic. I mean, that was the case where actually it was Paul Anderson, who works for NOAA at the labs in Kodiak for a long, long time. I think a lot of this kind of stuff comes from, it's interesting, it comes from the passionate dedication of a few individuals who keep doing the same thing over and over again, who keep going and doggedly measuring and, quantifying, you know, what's out there, you know, in their particular area of study. Now, he was their shrimp specialist in Kodiak. He did study lots of things, but he went out year after year after year himself on the research cruises, and he talked to fishermen, and he had a lot of, you know, hands-on knowledge about shrimp, and he collected that data himself personally, but he also worked with a lot of other people, and he did that for a long, long time, and he worked very close to hand in glove with Fish and Game, because I think both agencies were fishing together. They used the same gear, for the research, and he maintained data on all that. He got hold of it all, and yeah, it was Paul who somewhere in after the spill, who was pulling all this together after 30 years of doing work. And from one location in the Gulf of Alaska, he sort of put this picture together looking like, well, the shrimp had disappeared. But not only had the shrimp disappeared, but there was like 20 or 30 other species of fish and plankton that also not totally disappeared, but diminished greatly. But at the same time, a bunch of species like pollock and cod and halibut all increased at the same time. So over about a decade or so after 1976, when there was a major oceanographic change, there was this major change in the structure. You know, about 20 species went down and about 20 species, common species, went up. Paul was, you know, because he was doing that. And then the same is true for a lot of other, I think after, you know, at the same time, people in different disciplines were pulling together all the information they had on the oceanography, on the atmospheric conditions, on the phytoplankton, on the zooplankton, on the birds, on the mammals, and the fisheries. You know, the salmon, the data that we have from the whole West Coast, there were some folks who were pulling that together, like 100 years worth of salmon data, and they were seeing these patterns of decades when salmon were abundant and decades when they were scarce, and that there was this transition in the late 70s, early 80s called the regime shift now. But now we recognize there's lots of regime shifts, and this was one of them. But it was birds and forage fish were part of that story.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Steve, I think you made a really good point about the difference between directed research, which is going towards questions that we know something about, and we have a hypothesis, we have a sense, and the pieces that come up from ecosystem monitoring, which are things that we don't know yet are going to happen, you know, that get detected, that we can then go back and put together the pieces and figure out what happened. But there's things we frequently don't know about before we see them starting to happen.
Well, Chris Holdred, I'm glad you brought that up, because my next question is, this is really kind of a modest-sized program compared to what it could be. And I'm wondering if there's any potential for expanding it. If it can show its value in some way by shedding light on some of our big ecosystem situations we have right now, for instance, Chinook salmon and, you know, that sea survival or you know, other things like that. There's things involving, like, fisheries management, and there will be stuff about pathogens and predators and so forth. All that's changing because the climate's getting warmer, the currents are changing.
Yeah, one of the things, Steve, you make a really good point here, and this program has specific mandates under the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council, so it's looking at particular issues there. But taking into consideration the climate changes and ecosystem shifts. But piece of the program, a big piece of it, is integrating information from oceanography, from forage fish, from marine mammals, from fish. And the strength that we're seeing in that aspect of pulling stuff together, we're leveraging efforts from the different agencies. So, within NOAA, within the National Ocean Service and National Marine Fisheries Service, parts of NOAA, as John was talking about, some of the USGS work, Park Service is involved. I mean, there's a lot of leveraging of agency, both state and federal agency activities, as well as what's being funded by the Trustee Council. And I think the benefit of pulling that information together smartly within Alaska, within our marine systems in Alaska, I think that's one of the big benefits of this program that will go beyond just the funding of the program itself and something to be expanded upon.
How many years have we got funding for this now?
So there's a five-year phase. It's anticipated by the Trustee Council to be a 20-year program. We're in the first five-year phase of that program and just completing the second year of that five-year phase.
I don't know if you want to speculate or not, but, you know, if you had, say, a list of things you wish there was funding for.
That's going to be a very long list.
Well, I knew it would be, but like to pick three, let's say.
Well, one of the things that we end up, I mean, the simple, you know, the start of that answer is we have, you know, Alaska has half the coast of the United States, right?
And the I thought it was more than half.
Well, one can argue fractal dimensions.
The base, all right.
But, you know, say half. And the amount of effort that we have up here is, you know, very limited. The good thing is that because we all recognize that, we're actually pretty good about working together and trying to solve those problems together. You know, and I think the combination of smart fishery surveys, I mean, one of the things that we know that we are lacking is exactly this forage fish surveys. And John made some reference to shrimp surveys or small mesh trawl surveys, multi-species surveys that provide a lot of information about a lot of different species. You know, doing that kind of work routinely, that will be a partnership between the NOAA from our offices as well as the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. So right. Something that's been an advantage recently that hopefully will be continued, that most folks know about separate from this program, but is ocean acidification monitoring that's being done, you know, recognizing that that's an issue in northern waters, and then how does that feed into influencing the species that we've been talking about. You know, that's going to be a pressing concern for the next, you know, probably the next 10 years at least.
Yeah. Well, I think it's time to turn to our third researcher, who I did deliberately waited until later because he specializes in charismatic megafauna. It's a pleasure to welcome Craig Mackin to our microphone. Craig is director of the North Gulf Oceanic Society, and you've been researching killer whales for how long now?
Oh, getting on toward 30 years, I believe. Yeah, quite a
30
while.
30 years. I remember that long ago, before the spill, you and Rick Steiner were trying to figure out ways that people could keep the orcas from getting black cod because they figured out what the winches sound like.
That's right.
How's that going?
Jeez, do you have to bring up the tough spots in my research, the rocky spots? No, it's still a problem, and it's much more serious now at the Bering Sea than in Prince William Sound, although in Prince William Sound, it's still there. It left for a while after the spill, and now they're back at it, although last year we had a program out there to track it, and the whales didn't show up on the long line. So don't ask me what was going on there. But yeah, it's still around. But
it's forage fish are squirrely. You're supposed to be able to depend on these top predators.
Yeah, right. No, you can't. But I've got a grad student who I'm actually going down to her dissertation defense, and she's been working on this for the last 4 years or so. And it's a long dissertation, let me tell you. It's not an easy situation. But they also eat Chinook salmon in the wild, which brings us around to that question. And interestingly enough, at least one of the types of killer whales eats Chinook salmon. And I always have to start out with the defining the three types.
Please.
Because they are like three different species, and they probably will be at some point in time, or subspecies. And those are the resident types, the fish eater types. They're the salmon eaters, depend on salmon. And then there's the transient marine mammal eater types, harbor seals, sea lions. They're different types of transients within that, but let's just say They're the mammal eaters, the ones Eva was in here talking about not too long ago. And then we have the interesting new guys on the block, just because we didn't really, we weren't really aware of them much till lately, these offshore killer whales. And they are shark eaters primarily. They wear their teeth down to nibs. That's a whole nother story that's completely fascinating. And they are offshores because they spend most of the time offshore, which is why we have the excuse that we didn't know that much about them until years ago. And that's just the North Pacific, believe me. And the rest of the world, there's a bunch more types of killer whales, but these are well studied now and very, very differentiated and don't mix genetics-wise and socially. They're very different. So, but to go back to the mammal eaters, or the fish eaters, salmon eaters, we've got the residents, which have been increasing over the last several decades, really at a rate of about 3%, except for those that were caught in the oil spill. And that's another story. What the story is there, basically, with those animals is when you lose killer whales, they don't come back very fast. It takes them a long time. And this increase we've been seeing over the last several decades is basically a result, in my opinion, of the depressed state of the salmon stocks 30, 40, 50 years ago, and the fact that they have rebounded tremendously over that period. And the whales have gradually increased with them. Now we're starting to see some problems with certain species of salmon, notably Chinooks. And that's where we get concerned for the whales as well as for my own dinner table.
Well, yeah, I mean, everybody has their favorite kind of salmon, but I didn't really realize that these killer whales were, they distinguish species of salmon.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I guess the behavior is quite different of the different species, but still.
Yeah. Yeah, well, they basically look at them from the standpoint of availability and oil content, not unlike the seabirds, which they need to have those oily fish, the sand lance and the capelin. Pollock doesn't cut it, and for, I think, killer whales, it's somewhat the same. So
so there's a benefit to
There's a benefit to the oil, and that's what they're after. So Chinook are at the top of the list, and then there's cohos and chums, but all are very important. All three species are very important to them. And
okay, well, you don't have to answer this because a political question, maybe political, but I have to ask it just out of curiosity. Have you seen the documentary Blackfish?
Oh yes.
Oh,
yeah,
yes.
We did a little.
Do you want to voice an opinion on that, or?
Oh, sure. If you want to take it there,
yeah.
I think it's time to end captive
killer
whales. And there's a way out of this, I think, that could be a win-win situation. But it's a little bit of a long story. But we're not importing killer whales anymore at this point, but we are. Raising them in captivity, and that's going to have to end. But I think we can do that. I think we can do that.
Yeah. So it's an interesting moral situation, I think, with zoos that has been the antiquariums. I'm calling that a zoo, but there's just something morally ambiguous about it. There are functions that whether it's zoological captive breeding, actually having the animal there that you can do hard research on, and then there's this public spectacle part of it, and it's like, you know, it's a tough one.
Well, it's not a clear-cut line in the sand, but I think killer whales fall at the end of one continuum where they really can't be kept in captivity properly. There's been some research done in captivity, but those animals are really not open to research on the level what most scientists would like to see. And they've sort of outlived their use as far as educating the public as to what incredible animals they are. And now it's time to get on a whale watch boat, which you can in many locations, and go take a look at them. But I think it's a transition thing, and I think we're going to see over the next few decades that we transition out of this keeping killer whales in captivity.
Well, as you mentioned, we had your research partner Eva Salidis on, you know, talking about killer whales and the research that you and her have been doing for a long time now, and she clearly is transfixed by that one particular population and the individuals in that population. And I just wanted to get your reflection on that a little bit about if you feel that connection as well. Is there something in you that really responds to me, oh, that's so-and-so, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think with those animals, they are so different and such an oddity in that they are this small population that's completely different in so many ways, yet surrounded by this whole other massive killer whales, including other marine mammal eaters. It's just something compelling about that. But, you know, all in all, I think just the complexity of the societies and the behavioral ecology, if I may say, of these different types of killer whales who are all swimming out there in the same ocean next to each other, and to be able to sort of sort that out, to me, that is completely fascinating. It's such a complex situation, and not only from the standpoint of the individual types, but how they all partition out their own lives in the same ocean. It's fascinating.
Every time I talk with you, Craig Mackin, I get this overwhelming sense of mystery about it that I think is what excites you. You know, I'm thinking about when we talked about out in the Aleutians and how the killer whales were finding the gray whales and what their hunting tactics were and how the gray whales figured out that they could go where it was shallow, because that way the orcas couldn't come up from so far down below them. It's just, yeah. That's a big old world out there.
Yeah, it's great. And what's amazing is the different types have used different techniques in different areas to make a living. And it's every time you turn a corner, it's something new. And this offshore thing is so incredible because, well, you've got a shark resource out here. Well, who's using that? These Pacific sleeper sharks, of which there are quite a few. The longliners complain about them at times because they get on the blackout long lines. And lo and behold, here are these animals that come shooting in, eat a bunch of sharks inshore there in these deep areas, and go shooting out, you know. And they're not just eating the sharks. They're taking the shark liver, where 80% of the nutrition is. We had no idea what was going on until we started picking up these liver bits behind these whales, which took us quite a while to figure out, because it comes up way behind the whales, the bit of liver will float up, and then you see these birds back then, you go, aren't there a lot more birds here than there were before? And we finally realized they're jumping on these bits of shark liver, and that's what these guys are eating. It's incredible, to the point where it wears their teeth down, which very possible a lot of them die because of abscesses and this type of stuff. So, fascinating world.
Absolutely.
Totally different type of animal out there that we didn't even know about really 15 years ago. So,
well, that was getting a little yucky. I think we'll take a pause at this point as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com. And by the historic Anchorage Hotel, offering accommodations for up to 150 guests for business meetings or social event occasions. A boutique hotel in the heart of downtown. HistoricAnchorageHotel.com.
It's Talk of Alaska. It's live and statewide. We're speaking with researchers involved with the Gulf Watch Alaska program. It's the Gulf of Alaska they're looking at, largely funded by the Exxon Valdez Trustee Oil Spill Trustee Council, and it's an ongoing monitoring system for species and conditions in the Gulf of Alaska. I think it's become pretty clear in our discussion that they could use more money. They wouldn't mind expanding the monitoring and are full of ideas of what you might be able to find out if you did. But I'm opening up the phones at 1-800-478-8255, email talk@alaskapublic.org. It's a local phone call in Anchorage at 550-8422, but we're on statewide, and we'll start with R.K., who joins the program from Ketchikan. R.K., welcome to Talk of Alaska. Oh, R.K. is gone, but I know what he was asking about, and maybe somebody can answer this. I don't know. Fukushima, he was asking about. What about the radiation coming from Japan? People are very nervous about this, but as far as I know, we're not seeing that much. You want to say anything? Dead silence.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's true that we're not seeing it here. There's a couple good sources for information. So the EPA is actually tracking some of the radiation, so the environmental radiation. And if you have concerns about seafood safety, the Food and Drug Administration is tracking that. I don't have them with me right here, but there's websites for both of those that are set up specifically for the Fukushima radiation.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll go to Matt, joins the program from Sitka. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Matt.
Oh, hi, Steve. Thank you. I wanted to talk about killer whales, but I just want to mention that for the first time, I've lived out on an island here in Sitka for over 30 years, and for the first time that I've noticed this fall, we had some spawn going on in the fall, October. Normally, you know, I only see spawn in the spring, herring. But we went down there. We called Fish and Game to ask them what it was. We went down there, and there was a school of needle-like fish swimming around very rapidly. And we actually scooped some out of the water, threw them on the beach, and got three specimens, and they're in the freezer. They're sand lance, and they're in the freezer at Fish and Game. I don't know what they've done with them. We wanted to identify them, but we ended up identifying them from a book. And of course, we could be wrong, but I just thought that was interesting. I have never seen those on my beach before in over 30 years.
Let's see if I can get John Pyatt to comment on that. Sandlance spawning in the fall? What?
Well, that's when they spawn.
Okay.
And sandlance are the great misunderstood or not understood species. They're the most important forage species in the Northern Hemisphere in both oceans. There are several species of sandlance. But they live so close to the coast that we don't sample them very well offshore, so we don't really know much about them. But they're super abundant, and everybody feeds on them, and our Chinook salmon feed on them, and our whales, baleen whales feed on them, and all our seabirds feed on them. And they're very poorly understood. But one of the things about them is they do spawn in the fall. And I had a graduate student. It was funded by an earlier EVOS Trustee Council project in the 90s. We got interested in sandlance again because seabirds feed on them, and we were trying to understand their ecology better in Lower Cook Inlet. And so he started studying them, and he started looking at their reproductive condition through the course of the year, and then he tried to find out where they were spawning, and locals told him they were spawning in Kachemak Bay, places that they could be found. And sure enough, October, November, Martin Robards is the fellow who did this work, and I can remember him telling me his amazement when he went down there and saw sandlance emerging from the sediment on a cold, crispy cold October morning, freezing, very cold. It was like minus something, unusual cold. And they were frozen. You know, they had emerged and they were frozen. They were like all these little heads standing in a row in the beach. But he continued.
It's getting gross again.
He continued to study these fish, and yeah, they spawn in the fall. The larvae emerge in the winter. They go and they enter the water column in December, January, yeah. February, when nobody else is out there. This is an unbelievable fish, incredibly hardy, a real classic northern species. There's nothing like it. There's no other fish that does this. It's a crazy time to spawn, but there's no competition, so maybe that's the strategy.
Matt?
Yeah, it was fascinating to me. I have a mostly rocky beach, and there's a little patch of sand in the middle of it, and then these sand lance these fish showed up, and I had never seen it before on my beach. And in this area for a long time, we call different varieties of those kind of fish. We call them needlefish, you know. And they're an important part of, as you say, salmon feed and other things, certainly puffins. And I saw a blue heron feeding on these guys, too.
Have you seen eagles feeding on them?
Yes, there was one eagle down there, but I was trying to figure out how it paid for the eagle, you know.
Here's the deal with eagles, and then Martin discovered this, too, and I've seen it in Kachemak Bay. Low tide, the eagles go down to the beach. And they jump. You'll see them. They jump up in the air and they land on the beach.
Oh, they're scaring them out like with the shovel.
And you can do that yourself.
That's exactly what this eagle was doing at low tide. He was jumping up and down. I didn't know what the heck he was doing.
The fish pop out and the eagle just nabs them. And he just gets all these. And these are the big adults. These are like needlefish can get pretty big. And this is what they're doing. That's how Martin ended up getting all his samples of large mature fish, was going down to the beach with a shovel. But then he found out all he had to do was jump. And he could fill up his bucket.
Well, when these fish swim near the beach, my wife was in the water, and she just splashed some water up on the beach. They were circling in a, you know, not you know, a kind of circular motion, very rapidly, swimming in a huge loop and getting right into inches of water. And there was a little bit of a surge, not much. We're on the protected side of the island, and it was just, you know, I didn't know what the heck they were, and I never knew that fish spawned in October. That was news to me. But I wanted to talk about killer whales. And I would like to know more about sand lance because I don't know anything. But killer whales, recently my fishing group had been threatened by conditions of the L pod down in Puget Sound. And the L pod, as you may know, are where most of SeaWorld's killer whales came from, something like 70 different killer whales over a period of time, which really impacted the numbers. And it was stated that these killer whales lived exclusively on king salmon and that they were resident killer whales and they lived in the Puget Sound areas. But these killer whales have been photographed as far south as Monterey and as far north as Chatham Straits. And a lot of the places that the killer whales are, there's just no king salmon available at the time of year they're there. So I heard your researchers say that there are these three kinds of killer whales that they know in the North Pacific, and one feeds that, did he say, exclusively on king salmon? Because, you know, king salmon aren't really available exclusively in any one place year-round.
Right.
So I'd just like to hear more about that.
Yeah, up here I'm not claiming that they feed exclusively on king salmon at all. Down in with the southern resident population, which is the one that's in danger that you're talking about in Puget Sound, and as you accurately state, swim up and down the coast from Monterey all the way up to southeast Alaska.
That's a hell of a range.
Yeah, it is a hell of a range. And where they exclusively are eating king salmon is in summertime in those inside waters where they've been able to sample the prey. And there are a lot of people out there sampling both scales from kills and poop from the whales. And it's primarily king salmon. It's really important in the summer, and they figure that it's important for them to put on blubber for the winter. But what's happening in the wintertime on these outer coasts, really nobody knows, and they probably are eating things other than king salmon. And I think all these fish-eating killer whales probably are eating other fish in the wintertime at times. I've understood that they got some recently, just got some information by following animals out off California, and there's going to be some new feeding information out on these guys. But you're right. They're not exclusive to king salmon, except they may be in areas and at times of the year, and they may be a really important species.
I just got to throw in my two cents here in deference to charismatic megafauna, that the you got to know, of course, that the fish that the Chinook are feeding on in Puget Sound while they're waiting to be eaten by killer whales is
sand lance.
There you go.
Thank you. Matt?
It's all one big circle.
I would like to know more about sand lance. Can you recommend a book or something, you know, something accessible? I'm not a scientist.
Yeah, John.
I don't think there is a book on sand lass, but if I say that, somebody will probably point one out. Martin Robards did at one point pull together like a bibliography of all the work that's been done, a lot in the Atlantic, not so much in the Pacific. But I don't think there's a volume on, you know, maybe there's a need for that, a volume on forage fish, you know, that kind of gets into the interesting tidbits about some of these species.
It's very important to the whole ecosystem. I remember when I first got to Alaska, and I was talking to somebody about detrimental Tratsky. It was Lance Tratsky. And he said, well, and it's because of the capelin. They come up the... What? Capelin? What is that? Another one of the forage fish.
My graduate work was on capelin in Newfoundland on the east coast of Canada. I mean, that's what I studied, and I thought capelin were the center of the universe, and they are over there. I came to the Pacific, and nobody talked about capelin, and the birds weren't eating it, and nobody really cared. But it wasn't until many years after the oil spill, when we were looking at the food, the diet studies, you know, back in the early 70s, you know, people were shooting seabirds everywhere to look at diets. And that's how we did our sampling back then. 60% or better percent occurrence in their diets of all the common seabirds in the Gulf of Alaska was capelin. So, you know, and there was at one point the Fish and Game commissioned a study of capelin because they wanted to open a commercial fishery again back in the early 70s. They were abundant. They were everywhere. And then they disappeared. And,
regime shift.
Well, maybe they're coming back. So,
And that's an interesting point because, you know, just anecdotally, there a lot of folks were seeing capelin out there this year during our field season. So we'll see. Yeah.
Well, there's
news later.
A researcher on Middleton that has found that the birds are, you know, really eating capelin big time again. And it looks like maybe things have changed.
Wow. Yeah. Matt, thanks for that. That was a great question.
Matt, can I throw in one thing? You are actually a scientist if you're making these kind of observations. So congratulations to you for paying attention to what's going on around you.
Oh, it's fascinating. I've always done, my wife and I, especially, it's 30-some years of fishermen, 35. But it's all interlocked. The more you're out there, the more you realize everything is everything, you know, as we used to say in the 60s. And it is. There's been a long decline in needlefish in my region in southeast Alaska, and now they're starting to come back. And I hadn't seen a lot of capelin for a long time. I only see them in the bellies of the fish, right, when I dress the salmon. But this summer there was quite a bit of capelin west of Chatham. I didn't get south of Chatham, so I don't know what it was like down there. But west of Chatham, up west of Cross Sound, there was a lot of capelin, more than I've seen in 25 years.
Man, I just love it when this show does stuff like that. Yeah. I just love it. Yeah. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska, and by ERA. For more than 40 years, ERA Alaska's planes have carried the stories of Alaska. ERA Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. More at flyera.com. Since 1978, the Older Persons Action Group has been the publisher of Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide newspaper for older Alaskans and their families. They now offer a digital version online at seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Well, more calls calling in. RK from Ketchikan has finally been reconnected here. RK, welcome to Talk of Alaska. Did we address your question yet?
To a degree, yeah. I've fished all over the state also, long-lined, and had the pleasure of the killer whales putting on a great show, eating all of our black cod. And this program is, I love this program, especially when it's about fisheries. But I'm just concerned about the total silence, or almost total silence from the state, the Seafood Marketing Institute, and everybody about the possible radiation coming from Fukushima. I mean, the king salmon migration takes them right through there. And I would hope in the future that maybe this show could address that.
Well, I've tried a couple of times to look into it. And, you know, the radiation works really different in the water than it does in the atmosphere when it's, you know, falling out and so forth like that. And then there's the business of the way that it operates through the food chain and the specificity of the way that the animals move. I too am very concerned about it and looking for a good way to get a focused program on this. But frankly, I hear a lot of alarmism out there without too much underneath it right now.
Yeah, and I do also, and I have friends and family from down south and all over that when that bring up the subject of is Alaska fish safe because of Fukushima, and I don't really have an answer for them because I don't see any real comprehensive articles or programs describing what kind of testing is being done and how is our seafood guaranteed to be.
I think they could do a lot, but I think they're really behind the curve on this, to tell you the truth, RK. And I think part of it is because people don't really understand, like, with the fish biology and everything, but this stuff really moves through their system pretty fast. And it doesn't necessarily linger in the fish.
Right, but as laymen, we hear things like half-life of 10,000 years, et cetera. Uh-huh. More information, I think, would really benefit Alaska.
I think we all agree. Everybody's nodding their head here. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
Thanks for that, RK.
Well, yeah, and thank you for addressing this, and I hope we hear about it a little more in detail. I appreciate this show.
Okay, well, is there, maybe I can put it this way, Chris. Is there a contaminant monitoring component to Gulf Watch Alaska?
Sure. Different from not with respect to radiation,
no.
But particularly with respect to lingering oil monitoring. So the EVOS Trustee Council does several things in that regard, but the piece that's within the Gulf Watch program is once during the 5 year, we're going to be doing a survey of oiled areas, so the sediment side of it. So the and then there's tracer. Looking at biomarkers for oil with harlequin ducks and with sea otters. And both of those are feeding in the near shore, so they're feeding in areas where there can be lingering oil. So you can see that marker, the trace of the oil exposure in the animals themselves. So that's a piece that we're continuing. And a pretty exciting bit this year was they found for the first time in some of the harlequin ducks that were studied, there was no more trace of that exposure in some of the ones that they saw for the first time.
I've been waiting for that for almost 25 years.
For a long time, yeah.
So amazing.
Right. Yeah. So, and that's in the ones that they're studying, and, there'll be some follow-up from that. But that's pretty exciting news. Of course, it's also a long time.
Yeah. Well, how about sand lance? Sand lance seemed like lingering oil could affect an animal that... A fish that goes into the water, goes into the sediments heavily.
Well, I'm going to defer that question back to Chris.
I have no idea.
There were contaminant studies, that were done during Apex years ago. Yes, but it's not really my area.
Yeah.
And I haven't. Rather than speak out of ignorance, just pass it on.
I wouldn't want you to. It's Talk of Alaska, and Herman joins the program from ANIAC. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Herman, and thanks for hanging on with us.
Yeah, good morning. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you just fine.
Yeah, I'm the district manager for the Soil and Water Conservation District, and we're doing an aquatic habitat water quality study up here. And I kind of a three-part question to your panel. I know it's a common practice along the river here and many rivers in Alaska to, for these communities, they have to pump out effluent from the sewage lagoons. They say it's treated, but I don't know if it's common practice where you do that, where you are, but I'm trying to monitor to see what kind of, see if the salmon, new salmon are swimming out there. And my question is, by swimming for through that, it's getting the gills like hepatitis. Any kind of diseases can affect those salmon. And is it worth continuing the study? Kind of it's getting more and more. And I used to be on the Fish and Game Committee, and we used to wonder about all these hatcheries. Could be another problem. They're pumping out millions of fish are competing. They could be exceeding. trying to pass the ocean out there. You know, any study's been done on that? And another question, a lot of people on here, they see a lot of these fish stocks, merangers, you know, and they don't sort of stay here year-round. And could they be a factor by eating the minnows? And how many minnows can they actually fly? Huge flocks at 50 to 70 merangers flying around. But those are my questions, and I'll listen to you guys have any answers.
Yeah, Herman, so can you...
I study to see if this pumping of fruit is having an effect. You pump 400,000 gallons, another 200,000 gallons, and I'm wondering if it's diluted or is it floating to the top. I don't know. I'm wondering if I should continue to study.
Okay, I don't know how far we can get with any of that, but, you know, he's right there on the river and nervous about effluents going into the river.
Well, I think that's a big problem in lots of places, and, you know, effluents and, you know, not just in remote villages, but I know, for example, the town of Victoria in British Columbia dumps all their sewage into the Strait of Juan de Fuca. So it's a major problem, and Anchorage does the same. So it's a major problem in a lot of different places. And there are people looking at, you know, some impacts on some species, I would say that much. But it's I think to wrap this up, I mean, his other questions about what they're eating and what are the impacts of all those fish in the hatcheries. 20 years ago, I think, in an APEX, in an EVOS-funded meeting, somebody turned to me and said, has anybody ever looked at the impact of all the releasing millions of hatchery fish into the ecosystem and having them grow up and come back and eat all the forage fish that are also necessary for the birds and the mammals? Has anybody ever done like an, you know, environmental impact study on that? And everybody shook their head. Nobody could ever think that anybody had ever done that. You know, but maybe the biggest ecological impact in the Gulf of Alaska by humans, and nobody's ever really studied that.
I think we're still waiting for that.
So I think we're still waiting for that. Yeah. So I guess I would end by saying it's a great question, but and it points to what Gulf Watch is trying to do. It's an integrated science. We're trying to look at the oceanography and the chemistry of the ocean and the biology and right up to the forage fish and all the animals that depend on that. And it links to the killer whales. It links to what they're eating. It links to humans. And you know, that's part of the goal.
We're out of time. Thanks so much, everybody, for being with us to talk about Gulf Watch Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by
Providence Imaging Center, with its newest center in Soldotna, offering CT scans, MRI, ultrasound, and digital X-ray to residents on the Kenai Peninsula. Learn more at provimaging.com.
The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority is developing the Kinnick Arm Crossing to further develop the transportation system between Anchorage and the Matsu Borough. The bridge could create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and shorten the route to Alaska's interior and north slope. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. Many Alaskans are choosing to make energy efficiency improvements around their homes. Investing in efficient light bulbs or a programmable thermostat could save hundreds annually. For more tips on how to save money and energy, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.